Venture Capital's secret sauce.
Because there has to be a little bit of crazy. A little bit of, wait, that's never been tried before.
From American Public Media, this is Marketplace Tech. I'm Molly Wood. We are, as you probably know by now, introducing some of the topics we'll be covering in depth now that I'm your new host here at Marketplace Tech. And one of my obsessions is venture capital. This industry helps create companies that generate billions of dollars in revenue and tens of thousands of jobs at places like Google, Facebook, Twitter, even Apple. But most people have no idea how venture capital works, who invests the money, and how they decide where to put it. So we're going to look into that. Starting in the heart of the venture capital world, Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley. This is a deceptively quiet little office park, technically located in the city of Menlo Park, California. It's a place with big shade trees, manicured lawns, fountains, and this really peaceful woodsy feel. Sometimes actual bunnies run around on the lawn. You wouldn't guess at first sight that it's the symbol for the entire VC industry. Steve Jurvetson is a partner at Draper Fisher Jurvetson, a Sandhill firm started in 1985. They were big investors in little names like Twitter, Skype, Tesla, and SpaceX. I asked Steve, how does your job work?
I'm still trying to figure that out. And I think it, to be fair, varies quite a bit. So I can describe, of course, what I know and what I've seen. But it's the general, at a high level, we're trying to find the best entrepreneurs we can find with interesting and unique ideas that will change the world. We're in the riskiest sector of investment where most of what people undertake fails. We try to skew a bit towards projects that are more likely to succeed than fail. But even then, we're wrong a lot of the time. And so we have to have a portfolio of investments. So at a high level, we are an investment group. We raise pools of capital every few years. And we, in every case, invest money in exchange for a percentage of the company. You know, something between 20 and 40% is often the case for early stage rounds. And then we try to help those companies grow and be as successful as they can. And then eventually, the only way we make a return on our investment is when they go public in an IPO or get acquired by a larger company.
I think that's one of the things that makes this such an interesting story for us is that it is a bit of a black box. And yet, we're talking about huge sums of money, right? Like how much, if you had to guess in terms of global investment capital, how much of that is controlled on Sand Hill Road? What would you say?
Right. So if you're looking just at venture capital, I would guess that somewhere around 60% of the entire global pool is on this one street. And this one street's not very long. It's kind of mind-boggling. It is really concentrated in the United States to start, sort of the underwriters of the American dream. It's very concentrated within California, within Silicon Valley, and within Silicon Valley, within Sand Hill Road. The total number of jobs created, it's kind of staggering. What percent of the U.S. GDP comes from venture-backed companies? It's a staggeringly large number, as well as employment growth within the U.S. I think it's something between 20 and 30%.
So you have that. And then, like you said, there's sort of this virtuous cycle of then, so an entrepreneur gets really successful, they then become an investor, maybe in your fund, or they start their own fund. At what point, and it's a small world, and it seems like you don't hire a lot. Mm-hmm. Like, how insular is this world, and how much of an impact does that have on, you know, what kind of path dependency does that create in terms of entire industries?
The formation of a venture fund is not as easy as you might think it should be, at least. It's not as fluid and, it's not that easy. And so there aren't that many new entrants. And I think this is fundamentally one of the drivers of the bizarre concentration that you see in this industry, is it's just not that easy to go out and get into this business. There is then the second phase of your question, which is, how do you grow these firms? And I think there's a somewhat subtle, and for me, I totally missed this for the first 10 years, maybe 15 years on the job, but it's an important limit to how big a venture fund can be. I think team size highly correlates with success in our industry. We at DFJ once got up above 12 partners. Like at the time, we were oblivious to how much that might affect our investment efficiency. Basically, how well will we perform? And it plummeted. That makes it difficult for any one venture group that's had great success to scale.
So you have this relatively small group of people. You bring people in slowly, probably based a little bit on who you know. How does that affect the decision making?
It's an interesting question. Every investor is trying to compete with every other investor. You say, like, what in the world do I bring to the table that's slightly different, perhaps, than what everyone else has at the table? And there's something peculiar in your background, your education, your work, you know, your walk through life that you try to leverage. That quickly wanes, though. That change I think is a natural thing. When it comes to building a team, though, I think there's a real risk if you only hire people on your team that come from that same social network. In other words, if you just hire people that are like you in some sense of the word, that's not very diversifying. And you lack diversification both in that Rolodex, that process I described of what can they bring to the table, and you lack diversity cognitively around the table when you're trying to make decisions. So if you, the thing I've been championing here, for example, for quite a while now, probably 15 or 20 years, has been to try to only hire people that are very different from what we see around the table. Now, I'm not saying we're great at that, but that's something we aspire to do. And I think that traces back to the seed corn of our founding, which is the original founders of our firm, and I was the third. But Tim Draper and John Fisher are about as opposite as you can imagine. I mean, they are like the odd couple in so many different ways. It cracks me up. I think they almost hired me to just give them almost like a marital couple that needed like some therapist on board to resolve that they don't agree on anything, like everything. Like, I think that's really important in how a company forms.
You talk about that diversity as though it's like super obvious, and it is the way that you say it intellectually. But if you look around this industry, it's not really there.
It's not so obvious. Like, oh yes, this is a firm of a bunch of equally tall, equally skinny white men. Like, wow, that's kind of bizarre how that happened.
So how's that happening?
Well, I think how that happens in general, it happens unfortunately throughout a number of industries who are immature in their HR/hiring policies, which is if you don't put any thought whatsoever to it, if you don't have an HR department, and if you're overwhelmed with resumes that you can't possibly read, what do? Well, you fall back on some crutch like, well, shoot, I understand people who graduated from my school, so I'll just look there alone. And for many years, and I hope it's not as much today, but for many years, there was this, you know, obvious bias of there's only a handful of schools from which people came because that was like a self-perpetuating bias. I think it's more broadly called a homophily bias that in interviewing, in hiring, if you don't address it in any formal way or if you're not conscious of this, you can have an implicit bias to hire people like yourself. And so if you put aside, just to make this maybe less controversial sounding than it might, forget about gender or race as for a moment. Just think about how obvious it sometimes seems for people who are high energy to hire other people who are high energy. Whenever someone in a public forum asked a venture capitalist, or frankly in a private forum too, but public, there's plenty of examples of this. You know, what does it take to be a successful VC? What background do you need to be a successful VC? 100% of the time, you got an answer that was their background. It really detailed their, like one person at a firm would say, you need 10 years of operating experience. Bingo, that's what they had. It's a really strong cognitive bias.
Let's talk about the sort of the investment philosophy and returns and how investment decision-making works. Like, you get in a room with people, you know, now we could, and there are venture firms that are doing this. Now we could, in theory, use algorithms or computers, right, to figure out what's going to be a high or low risk investment opportunity. Like, how do those decisions get made, and how do you know that they're better than, you know, what a computer might pick with a certain amount of data?
Because everyone in every sphere of the investment trade has got to be wondering, when does a deep learning algorithm make me obsolete? We're probably on the other end of that spectrum as a cottage industry with archaic systems and a real very difficult to quantify aspects of decision making. So, for example, imagine Elon Musk, right? How would you have measured prior to his success any of the attributes that you'd want to correlate with his subsequent success? I dare anyone to even say what they try to measure, much less could they. And so there's a judgment call there. Again, anyone's submission is not an isolation. You hire for different people, everything changes. Voting policies change. For example, we actually worry if we're have a consensus because we probably have too obvious an idea in front of us. If everyone thinks it's a bad idea, it might very well be a bad idea. The difference between crazy and brilliant is sometimes a very fine line. Because there has to be a little bit of crazy, a little bit of, wait, that's never been tried before. I mean, that actually has to be there. And in fact, a filter I've used throughout my entire career that applies from day one to today is I try to invest in things that are unlike anything I've seen before. So I generally try to invest personally in things that don't have any of that corroboration from the outside. We can't rely on outside experts. We can't turn to market research firms. You have to go with your gut.
What are some of the biggest shifts you've seen in this industry?
The biggest one that jumps to mind for me is the incredibly broadened scope of industries that we can address today versus when I started. In the 90s, the internet was just starting to happen. The mainstream of venture, sort of in the late 80s and early 90s, was software, semiconductors/computers, so like, you know, these chips and what they're used for, and biotech. And that was it. Today, I think you're seeing a much more exciting diversity of industry sectors and types of companies in that, whereas literally in, like in the 90s, It'd be like, no, I don't, like, the things we don't invest in was a very long list. It was a very understood list. No, we don't do oil and gas. No, we don't do timber. No, we don't do movie projects. No, we don't. And like, in that list would have been, oh, we don't do automotive. And we don't do anything industrial. We don't do agriculture. It's just like, the no's would have been like almost all the economy. The amount of capital that's coming in the industry, my gosh, it, as many people might know, it burgeoned like crazy in the dot-com period. By the way, it's an important point. In a bubble, you see the companies that benefit from the bubble, the ones that get a lot of money. Some would say perhaps with an envious eye, way too much money than they deserve at way too high a price and too easily. Yeah, that's great. That's the envy part. What's not reported because they're invisible are the folks who get nothing. So even if you lambast a pets.com or one of these kind of ridiculous poster child of excess, there are probably many other pets.com like companies that got no money. And it's not that we, in that particular case, care so much about them, but in other categories that do matter, like amazon.com competitors or eBay competitors, there's actually a bunch of really interesting business ideas that withered on the vine. Certainly a lot of Google competitors, I can tell you that for certain. There are better search technologies, much better products that were launched just after Google was launched, and some before, that got nothing and quietly went out of business all over the place. Probably 30 or 40 companies, I would guess. Yeah. Yeah. Most of whom will never be known.
That is probably, like, you've nailed exactly the thing that makes venture so interesting and perplexing and important, which is that but for minor variations in decision-making, our world could look completely different. Like, do you ever feel the weight of that responsibility?
Oh, gosh, that's an interesting question. No, because I believe in the ecosystem. If I was the only arbiter, like if we were a government-sponsored monopoly, God, yeah, then that would be kind of incredibly difficult. And that's why I think government-funded or sponsored venture programs overseas are really problematic. You need an ecology, and if there's something that's underfunded for long enough, hopefully that will create an opportunity. So I have some fundamental belief in markets that these dislocations, while weird, hopefully are not long-standing.
You might have guessed already just from this interview that Steve Jurvetson is a brilliant person with a lot of interesting things to say, and he says them all really quickly. If you would like to endure that for more like half an hour, you should head on over to our website, marketplacetech.org. We have the mostly uncut interview in the source code section. I'm Molly Wood. This is APM.